Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee to order. Members, please take your seats. I do see that we have a quorum present. Before we begin our agenda today, I would like to remind the committee of a few housekeeping rules. Everyone in the audience must be seated when they are in the hearing room. Please, no sitting or standing in the walkways or in the aisles. This will allow us to keep the accessible seating available for those who need it. Please leave all signs outside the hearing room. All testifiers who signed up in advance have been provided time to testify. I reserve the right as chair of the committee to impose a time limit on comments. Time limits are provided so we can keep our meeting on time and hear from as many people as possible. We will usually ask the room if there are further testifiers who would like to speak, but that may not always be possible. Thank you for your understanding and adhering to the rules. Our first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes from our Monday, March 11th meeting. Is there a motion to approve? Representative Engen.
That is my motion, Mr. Chair.
Representative Engen moves the approval of the minutes from March 11th, 2024. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries and the minutes from Monday, March 11th are approved. Members, our first bill on the agenda today is House File 4014 from Chair Akam. Chair Akam would like to come down to the committee. Because Chair Akam is not a member of the committee, I will move to re-refer House File 4014 to the Human Services Finance Committee. Chair Akam, welcome to the committee. Would you like to introduce your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would. Thank you. The opioid crisis in Minnesota continues. Fortunately, there are effective treatments for those with opioid addiction. The most effective, methadone, reduces the risk of death of acquiring or transmitting HIV by more than half. Unfortunately, it's a challenge to get access to this medication. Following recommendations from the National Academies of Sciences, the federal government has changed some of the regulations surrounding methadone. Prior to these changes, patients had to pick up their medication daily or for the first 3 months of treatment, followed by a stepwise decrease in clinic attendance over the first year in treatment. This time-based attendance schedule was independent of patient stability, such that it did not matter how well a patient was doing. They still had to come to clinic daily or several times a week. This attendance served as a barrier to treatment. People living great distances from a clinic could not afford the cost or time to travel to the clinic daily. People with childcare responsibilities or reentering the workforce could not meet these obligations due to the clinic schedules. Too many people do not enter into treatment or leave treatment due to these restrictions. The new federal regulation eases some of these restrictions, allowing attendance to be based on clinical stability rather than on time. The bill before you seeks to harmonize Minnesota Statute Chapter 245G with the federal rule. We anticipate that this will improve access to and retention in treatment for opioid addiction and thus decrease deaths and improve community health. By reducing the frequency of clinical attendance, we also anticipate a reduction in medical transportation costs. Finally, by aligning with the federal rule, this bill will also ease work of government such that Minnesota will not need to continually play catch-up as the rule changes over time. And with that, Mr. Chair, there are some speakers who are here to testify, or some testifiers, excuse me, here to testify in support of the bill.
Okay, thank you, Chair Akam. I do see that we do have a few that have signed up. I would ask that as people come down to keep in mind that we do have a two-minute limit on testimony because we do have a number of bills today. So the first person I have is Dr. Gavin Bart. If you'd like to come down, please. Appreciate you being here and taking the time to come down to the Capitol. If you could please introduce yourself, let us know who you're with and begin your testimony, and welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, committee members, and thank you, Chair Fisher. My name is Dr. Gavin Bart, and I am an addiction medicine physician, and I direct the Division of Addiction Medicine at Hennepin Healthcare. I'm also medical director of Hennepin Healthcare's opioid treatment program, to which this rule pertains. As you heard from Representative Acomb, Methadone is a highly effective medication for opioid use disorder, but remains, due to high-level regulation within the state of Minnesota, very inaccessible due to travel time. We want treatment to become a way to life rather than a way of life. Mm-hmm. And by having people spend inordinate amount of time traveling to clinic, being in clinic, it is disruptive to their ability to get reestablished on their feet with their families and communities. Basically, this bill is to harmonize with revised federal law that went into effect in February of 2024 that makes the decision on frequency of clinical visits linked to federal law and based on physician or provider assessment of the patient rather than a pure time frame in treatment. I believe that this will simplify our ability to treat people and will simplify government process. Every time the feds change the rule, Minnesota will be yoked to that and it will remain in harmonization. So I would speak very much in favor of this so we can bring great benefit to our patients who are disrupted by having to come to our clinic as frequently as the current law requires.
Very good. Thank you, Dr. Bart.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Next, I have Jessica Shortall. If you'd like to come forward, please. Thank you for taking the time to come down to the committee today. Please introduce yourself, who you're with, and please begin your testimony.
I'll apologize for my allergies in this non-winter. Thank you all for the opportunity to speak in favor of HF 4014 today. My name is Jessica Shortall. I lead a coalition called Safer from Harm, which is comprised of diverse organizations from faith to racial justice to law enforcement that support public policy that improves access to harm reduction tools. That coalition is powered by R Street Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy organization dedicated to free markets and limited effective government. In short, we believe that government should not hinder people's access to evidence-based tools that can keep them safer and healthier. Methadone is just such a tool. It's considered a gold standard treatment for long-term opioid use recovery that can help people return to healthy, stable lives, empowering them to work, meet family obligations, and do the things we want our loved ones and neighbors to be able to do. Today's bill would bring Minnesota into harmony with recent federal updates to how methadone take-home doses are provided, as you've heard, removing some arbitrary regulations and giving doctors greater ability to care for their patients' unique needs. I have heard so many addiction medicine docs describe methadone as truly life-changing in treating opioid use disorder. It's proven in study after study to be more effective for long-term recovery than treatments that don't use medication. It's also crucial to our big picture efforts to turn the tide in the addiction crisis. By giving people an effective way to transition away from illicit opioid use, methadone can reduce demand for illegal opioids like heroin and fentanyl, which makes our communities safer. Decades of overregulation have created huge barriers to accessing this life-saving medication. As you've heard, many patients must travel up to 6 days a week to a specialized clinic, a requirement that's not in place for any other prescription drug in this country. Especially in rural Minnesota, some have to travel an hour, 2 hours or more each way, and you can imagine how disruptive that is. This burden keeps many people from starting and staying with treatment and from steady work and a stable life. Recent federal changes give doctors more flexibility on when to give patients take-home doses, as you've heard. That'll reduce daily commutes and help people live normal lives, which I think is something we all want. These changes put patients more firmly, their care more firmly in the hands of their doctors. So because HF 4014 will harmonize Minnesota statute with these federal changes, we strongly support the bill and urge the committee's favorable report. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for being here today. Are there any other testifiers who would like to address the committee? Not seeing any members. Any questions or comments? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Acum, thanks for bringing the bill. It's a great one, and I'm sorry I missed you on the floor today. Maybe this is what we're going to expect. I know. Thank you. I was a little late. I support this idea a lot. I think Dr. Bart Gavin said it really well, that our folks that are working through their recovery with this very highly addictive kind of medicine that's working really, really well, if it's used right, provides a lifestyle that we need to make sure they can start living their life again without being just tied down to this anchor that they have so many of. So I like I like the rules that they've changed. We had to do a lot of those with the federal government because it's so federally regulated, this thing, methadone. And I love that we're going to save money by transportation costs. I like that we're going to, but maybe my question might be, and maybe I have to have the doc come back up, is what will this do to our providers? Will they take less as well because they will see the patient likely less? How does that work in their mind if we can maybe find that? Maybe you know that answer, but maybe the doctor might know that too.
Dr. Bart is coming right back down here. Thank you, Dr. Bart, if you'd like to go ahead and respond to the question.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Currently in the state of Minnesota, treatment in opioid treatment programs is compensated through a capitated per diem system that is under evaluation for rolling out a bundled payment system that is done in weekly bundles. We do not anticipate that having patients come to clinic less frequently would be disruptive to that payment system. In fact, we want to make sure that there's not any adverse or perverse incentives to providers to have patients come to clinic more often than they need to just in order to make money. That would not be fair to the patient. So I believe things are currently separated enough in these bundled payments that there would not be this perverse incentive.
Representative Baker.
No, and thank you for that, Dr. Bart. I agree with that. I also know the investment in our providers is a lot of this upfront stuff when you first get new intakes and have them really work through that process. That's where, you know, you get them on the right pathway, the right kind of wiggle room and the right type of a trust level that you have to do. And I think this is going along very well with our new updated version. So, hey, federal government changed it in February. We're here sitting in March. That's pretty good. So let's move it along. I think it's a great bill, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Any other comments? Hearing none, Representative Akam, Chair Akam, if you'd like to make closing comments, please.
Thank you for the opportunity to present the bill and appreciate the comments and the support.
Thank you, Chair Akam. I renew my motion that House File 4014 be re-referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails and the bill is re-referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. Thank you, Chair Akam. Next on the bill, we have a bill, House File 4391 from Representative Hemmingsen-Yeager. There we go. Come on down to the table because Representative Hemmingsen-Yeager is not a member of the committee. I will move to re-refer House File 4391 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Hemmingsen-Yeager, and please introduce your bill.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I hope everyone had a good, not too stressful lunch. Thank you so much for hearing my bill today. This is a nice, easy DHS policy bill. It makes changes to the medical assistance, behavioral health, home benefit, and housing programs. My understanding is there was an informational hearing back on February 14th, so hopefully this is nothing too surprising or new. It also cleans up language and removes obsolete provisions in the general assistance statutes. It has been vetted, I'm told, with community partners, and it's intended to ensure that people are at the center of mental health program processes and that the housing support provider processes are simplified and unambiguous. So I like consistency and I like simplicity. So, and then you can see Christy Graham is next to me to help quickly walk through the bill. So thank you.
Okay, very good. Director Graham, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Christy Graham with the Department of Human Services. Really appreciate the opportunity to hear this bill today. I want to thank Representative Hemmingsen-Yeager for authoring it. So I'll just walk through each section pretty briefly. We did have an informational hearing, so happy to answer any questions if there's more detail that committee members want to hear about. So sections 1 and 2 have to do with a behavioral health home benefit that was mentioned just a bit ago. And so this is a care coordination medical assistance benefit that supports people who have pretty significant mental health concerns. So it's for adults, for children, and really helps to coordinate their care across an integrated service delivery model. So there are two changes in this for this benefit that this bill will be making. The first change is really to focus more on person-centered engagement. This would remove the requirement that a provider needs to get written consent for a person to be able to initiate services. So this is a learning that we've had through the pandemic, where people did not used to have to get written consent during the pandemic. It worked out much better for people. Providers were able to meet people where they were at. They typically, individuals using these services typically have some pretty chronic health issues, and so it just makes it easier for them to access that service. And so this change would just allow people to consent to getting the service telephonically or electronically. And we do currently have variance authority for this, so we have some providers that are already utilizing this flexibility. And then secondly, for this benefit, we're going to be streamlining some of the provider requirements. So right now there's a requirement that providers use the Human Services Partners portal to identify past and current treatment and services, really to work on that care coordination aspect. And what we've heard is that portal is based on claims data, which is up to 3 months old. So it's not really effective for the intended purpose. We are changing that to allow providers to use a tool that's identified by DHS. Moving to section three, this is just updating a general assistance effective date that was missed last session. So there was a really significant increase to general assistance last year. Yay, we are so appreciative of that. Really historic change. And that's effective this October, so October of 2024, but one of the effective dates in the bill said 2023. So we're just aligning it with the spreadsheet agreement. Section four is related to housing support and making some clarification. So under housing support, programs need to be licensed or registered, and they all have to meet, the intent is that they all meet a minimum set of requirements, and that intent is also codified in their contracts that they have with counties. So those minimum requirements are things like food preparation, laundry, you know, maintenance and operation, making sure they have a bed, linens, things like that. But there are a few types of providers that are exempt from certain registration requirements, and so this change just makes sure that those providers that are exempt from having to be licensed or registered still have to meet the basic minimum program standards, just aligning with their housing support agreements. Sections 5 and 6 are related to housing support again, related to our budget neutral transfers. So in the housing support program, there are a couple of ways that providers can get reimbursed for the services and the board and lodge that they're providing to individuals. So one way is that they get direct payments based on an individual. Another way is that a county or a tribe might get a lump sum payment based on a period of time and expenditures over that time. And it's just a way to make payment a little bit easier for them, especially when they're dealing with transient populations, when people are coming in, coming out, so that they don't necessarily have to worry about filling a bed right away. And there really is enough demand to do that. But it's just a more efficient way for them to get payment. And right now we have those payments structured in two different areas of statute. So this just kind of recodifies those areas into one place. So it's really clear what the expectations are. And then section 7 is really just some renumbering of general assistance statutes related to a repealer at the end of the bill that repeals the poor relief program from general assistance, which I gave this committee a little history lesson on before, so I won't go into depths in terms of what that is, but it's an obsolete, no longer functioning program. And that is the bill. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay, very good. Are there any testifiers that would like to address the committee? Not seeing any members, questions? Not seeing any questions. Thank you, Director Graham, for helping out with the presentation there. Representative Hemmingsen-Yanger, any closing comments you'd like to make?
No, just again want to extend my thanks to Christy Graham and the Department of Human Services. Again, I just really appreciate, you know, making government work for everybody, and especially having the person-centered approach. So I would appreciate your support. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Hemmingsen-Yanger. I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 4391 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion is approved, and House File 4391 is re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you for being here today. Next, we have on the agenda House File 3486. This is Representative Chair Freiberg's bill. If Chair Freiberg would like to come down, I'd like to have this bill voted on by 1:50, so we've got enough time for discussion on this. I move to re-refer House File 3486 to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. Chair Freiberg, welcome to the committee. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I have an A2 amendment also.
A2.
A2 or A3?
Oh, actually, I think some terms might have been updated in it. It might, I think it is the A3 now that you say that.
Okay. If we'd like to, I will move the author's A3 amendment. Chair Freiberg, would you like to explain your amendment?
Sure. This reflects suggestions from DHS, the Department of Corrections, and the licensing boards. Would put the bill in the shape I'd like.
Okay. This is get the bill in the shape the author would like. Any questions? Hearing none, all in favor of the author's A3 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion is approved and the amendment is added on, so we will go to explanation of the House File 3486 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Minnesota Recovery Options Act is a straightforward bill to ensure that Minnesotans who are being required to receive substance abuse disorder treatment by the state receive care that is appropriate for them. Minnesota has a strong interest in effectively addressing substance use disorders among those involved with the criminal legal system. Approximately 90% of incarcerated people in Minnesota have been diagnosed with a substance use disorder, and such disorders can increase recidivism if left untreated. As a state, we've made significant efforts to address these issues, and Minnesota has among the best substance use disorder treatment programs in the world. However, in some cases, individuals are being required by the state criminal legal system to participate in programs that are inappropriate for them, which can undermine recovery. For example, individuals may object to religious or other elements of substance use disorder programs. Many of the most common peer-based recovery programs are 12-step programs, which typically have religious or spiritual elements. Other programs may discourage medication-assisted treatment, which is recommended as a best practice and important to recovery for many people. And these programs work well for a great many people. Many folks have achieved and maintained sobriety through programs like Alcoholics Anonymous. However, it's clear they don't work for everyone. In particular, non-religious Minnesotans, who make up about 1/4 of the population, and religious minorities, who are about 5% of the population, may object to being required by the state to participate in religious programming that conflicts with their beliefs. We're not talking about people objecting to being required to participate in substance use disorder treatment in general. Many recognize that they need help and want to receive it. But the religious components in some programs can be a barrier for those who object to them, and that can make these treatment programs less effective. Courts have also found that it is unconstitutional to require individuals to participate in religious treatment programs that they object to. However, people involved with the criminal legal system may not know about their rights, or they may not be in a situation where they can assert their rights. Therefore, this bill takes a proactive approach, increasing the range of appropriate treatment programs available, providing notice to individuals of their rights, and reinforcing existing constitutional protections on this issue throughout the criminal legal system. This bill is meant to ensure that every person required by the state to receive substance use disorder treatment is able to access treatment appropriate to them, not be forced into a one-size-fits-all option. It will reduce recidivism, respect religious freedom, and help reduce liability by ensuring that individuals' rights are not violated. The simple fact is that no one should ever be forced by the state to take part in religious programming they object to, and their recovery and freedom should never depend on it. By making appropriate treatment more accessible, this bill will help achieve that goal. And I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Chair Freiberg. I believe the first person I have is Stephen Kind.
Correct.
Thank you for taking the time to be here today. If you'd like to please introduce yourself, who you're with, and begin your testimony. And I'm providing 2 minutes for each testifier.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Fisher.
You're welcome.
My name is Steve Kind. I've served the state of Minnesota as a certified peer recovery specialist, and I'm currently serving as the Minnesota Outreach Coordinator for the Smart Recovery National Office. The Recovery Options Act means a lot to me, as I've seen firsthand what happens, when limited options are available to finding a successful recovery. It started with my own story of being unaware of the alternatives to 12-step programs. I went through treatment 4 times, countless AA and NA meetings, spanning the ages from age 19 up to age 54. My attempts at sobriety never reached 6 months in length. My last attempt at sobriety was different. A forward-thinking counselor at the last 12-step facility I attended suggested that I look into Smart Recovery. She was not real familiar with Smart Recovery, but she encouraged me to investigate it and see what it was all about. Thanks to her suggestion, I found a program that fit me. I'll be celebrating 6 years of sobriety in June of this year. Soon after finding my sobriety, I received training as a certified peer recovery specialist and began working at a men's house in southern Minnesota. I was helping to manage a house with 18 men. In doing my weekly interviews with these men, I was seeing my personal story mirrored in some of them. Many were happy with the 12-step pathway to sobriety and doing quite well. There were others that were struggling with that pathway. These men felt coerced, as one of the house rules was a requirement of meeting weekly with a sponsor. Sponsors are only part of 12-step programs. As a SMART recovery facilitator, I see many who have struggled with AA or NA and found relief in finding a program that fits them. About half of our group does SMART recovery and another program such as AA or NA or Celebrate Recovery. Pathways to a peaceful and successful sobriety are about as varied as the people seeking it. I ask that you pass this important legislation to help those searching for the right program find it and thrive in their sobriety. Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be here, and thank you for your testimony. Thank you. Next testifier I have is John Capesius, if I'm pronouncing that properly. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
My name is John Capesius. I'm a SMART facilitator, have been for about a year and a half. When I first needed treatment, I went into a 12-step program, and I learned that 12-step wasn't going to be something that was going to sustain me. So I was kind of, to graduate from it, I needed to be in a 12-step or some kind of recovery program with a sponsor. And my counselor had never even heard of different alternatives, didn't recommend any alternatives. Someone else in my group gave me the option of SMART. And so as I looked into SMART, it definitely fit me better with a scientific background, and it focuses on that. There's many out there. AA does work very well for some. SMART was just my path, and that is what got me sober. Now, last night I facilitated a meeting with 17 people in it from all over the country, and everyone in there basically said if it wasn't for SMART, they wouldn't be sober right now. They all had different backgrounds. And some had been in AA for years, some had not, but they all did agree that without SMART, they wouldn't be sober today. So I think everyone needs to be able to do recovery their way, or it's not going to work, because if you're at all forced, it doesn't work. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mr. Capesius, for being here and for your testimony. Appreciate it. Next, I have Juneel Colburn, if you'd like to come forward. Thanks for taking the time to come to the Capitol today. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Juneel Colburn, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here today. I work professionally as a qualified rehabilitation consultant with as a QRC, working with workers' comp. But I have a wide background, and I started out as a chemical dependency counselor in my first life back in the late 90s. And with the beginnings of Hennepin County Drug Court, I was honored to be able to pilot that with Judge Burke. And I watched people coming out of the Department of Corrections system, and they were a little bit lost. They were all forced into the 12-step program. And as you'll hear, as you've heard today, it's wonderful for some. But for others, it was, people were kind of stuck. And I worked with, the one person who sticks out in my mind was a Native American gentleman who would spend all of his time going to the 12-step meetings, and then he would skirt around and head over and meet with the elders. And be given the opportunity to practice his Native American spirituality, and he would come to my office and tell me that that was what it was that was going to work for him. He wasn't going to, but he would jump through the hoops and go through the other programs if that's what they required of him. Personally, later in my life, I developed a chemical use problem, and I used alcohol as my drug of choice. I have 22 months sobriety actually today, and I started out with AA. I would go to speaker meetings, and at the end of the meeting, or when I was asked to introduce myself, I would say that I was in recovery. Hi, my name is Juneel. Alcohol is my drug of choice, and I'm in recovery. I got pulled aside by the elders at the meeting and said that that's not a word that we use around here. And that was very difficult for me to go back to those meetings after being told that that wasn't going to be acceptable for them, that verbal, that language. And I did go into treatment and was introduced to Recovery Dharma, which is a meditation-based Eastern program that became very, very helpful to me. It was what I latched onto and in the beginning, and is what helped me find my sobriety. I also found Smart Recovery upon my graduation from treatment, and have become a Smart facilitator. What I love about the program is that they allow people to meet recovery on their own terms. They aren't judgmental. The people are allowed to be vulnerable. They use transformational stages of change, motivational interviewing, cognitive behavioral therapy, rational emotive behavioral therapy. They attach a lot of tools, and so that those people are allowed to express their emotions and go to their counselors and have their treatment and recovery program match the professional care that they're getting outside, if that's what they're choosing to do. And that's all that I have for you today, but thank you very much for the opportunity.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Thank you for your sharing your experiences with us. We appreciate it. Are there any other testifiers that would like to testify on this bill? Not seeing any, I'll go to questions from the committee. First person I have is Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and Representative Freiberg, excuse me, for your bill. I always do that wrong. And thank you to the testifiers, and congratulations on your 22 months. I'm 10 days short of 4 years, so it's a big deal. Congratulations. I just wanted to get some, it sounds like the space that we're working in is kind of reentry and in incarcerated and reentry programs, but does this bill apply to all SUD programs and any placement or voluntary SUD treatment programs? Do you know?
Chair Freiberg.
No, this bill is primarily about reentry, so there's the chapters of law that it relates to deal with corrections, treatment programs related to corrections, criminal sentences, release, substance abuse disorder license, treatment facilities, provider personnel policies, mental health uniform service standards act. It's primarily about reentry.
Okay.
Sorry, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, well, that's good to know. I'm one of the things that I think about a lot when we're talking about religion and SUD programs, especially for my community, you can't go far without meeting a trans person who has not been able to stay in an SUD program because of non-affirming religious teachings. It's very common. It's very difficult for trans people to be affirmed and in treatment. Unfortunately, there just aren't that many options, and some of our most present and visible SUD programs are explicitly anti-trans. So that's something I'd like to talk about more in our committee in the future, but it sounds like this is, to the extent that there are, our community is heavily incarcerated, so of course this overlaps, but that's a broader conversation I look forward to.
Thank you, Representative Finke. Any other comments or questions? Representative Baker.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. This is interesting. I guess I appreciate the testifiers today because everybody has their own way of recovery and healing. I think the testifiers today are spot on. There's different methods, and some people choose more heavily religious factors like Teen Challenge. Some are the 12 step. All of them kind of use that same general philosophy of a higher power, but it's also very different in how it's approached. So it's very lightly in some, it's a very light model, some are heavier. But my concern is only, not that we shouldn't have these choices, not that I'm going to get hung up with, you know, what the atheists want to do here for this type of recovery. That's not it. It's my fear is maybe what the department thinks about creating this new lane of treatment and the rules that are going to likely follow this kind of a bill and the pressure it's going to put on our entire system to have now with folks that are going to be required by the courts to go to a place that may not exist because it's either a different place or it's not very many beds are out there. I'm worried about just this new line of thinking and the capacity that's ahead of us. So maybe this is just more of an aspirational thing that we should make sure that those choices are allowed. My fear is, and maybe to your thoughts on this, Representative Freiberg, is what about folks that are willing to go to treatment but are going to be so challenging to work with in the court systems that nothing is good enough or nothing is non-religious enough for them to take a yes answer to someplace. So is that a concern, or am I overreading this? I'm worried about the pushback we're going to get by maybe some folks who really don't want to do treatment. Courts really want them to do it, but there's nothing in that lane for them to take.
Chair Freiberg.
Yeah, that makes any sense.
Thank you. That's an excellent question, Representative Baker. I know you and I have had a brief discussion about this, and I know you've met with the advocates offline, too, which I appreciate.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to keep working with you on this, too, as this moves forward. I know it does need a couple more committee stops. I mean, if you look throughout the bill, I think one thing I did hear in the feedback we got from the agency is that in some areas there may not be a non-religious option, and we do want to make sure people have some sort of treatment available to them. So if you look through the bill, just to give you one example of the first instance it appears, like on line 2.14, it says, if an equivalent alternative treatment program is not available within a reasonable time, the offender may decline to participate in any religious element of a treatment program to which the offender objects. So I'm not an expert in, the 12-step program or anything. I know one of the 12 steps, from my understanding, is recognition of a higher power. So I imagine there would, with that one provision set aside, there would still be plenty of options there. If there's ways the language could be tweaked, though, I'd certainly be more than happy to discuss it with you as this moves forward, because I know you have a lot of expertise to offer in this area.
Representative Baker.
And I appreciate that. I think I really have relied a lot on the agency for these kinds of, choices and actually their concern about as you start going into a different kind of a treatment methodology, and again, a lot of these are being practiced in different ways now. I'm just nervous that we're going to put a lot of pressure, and I'm not saying it doesn't need to happen, but I'm just saying I'm curious about what the agency has to say. We don't have to do it today or have them come down today, but at some point I want to know what they're if they have any heartburn. Maybe they don't, and maybe they feel good about this, and maybe this is the place that we've got time to bring them down, but I know that this is a question that I have, because I fear this is going to create a lot of work down the road, and I'm not sure how many folks are really asking for this. And maybe that's part of it too, is what is the demand out there? What is the percentage? I mean, I'm just kind of curious. So good. I see
yes.
Our friend has come down, so thank
yes.
you.
For Director Grom, thank you for thank being you. Here. If you'd like to come up, and address the questions that Representative Baker is asking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Christy Grom with DHS. So I assume that bill authors have also spoken with the Department of Public Safety, because they're a big player in this, win this bill too. And so we have worked with the advocates that are proponents of this bill. I think we're overall neutral on this. We support the policy direction. Some of the reforms that this legislature made last year around direct access, or finalized last year into state law, actually allow people to make these choices already. So we don't have a placing authority anymore where counties say, this is the treatment that you have to go to. So people really get to make their own choice based on what's going to be best for them, and what their medical necessity is under our current medical assistance system. And so I think the courts do differ a little bit, and I don't think that they are not subject to that direct access reform, so it's a little bit different in that space. But overall, I know we've provided some technical assistance, and we're looking at the amendment, and if there are further tweaks, we'd be happy to continue working with bill authors and working with you, Representative Baker, and others.
Thank you, Director Grom. Representative Baker.
Yeah, and thanks. I think as I have listened to this more and have more time really to talk about this with Representative Freiberg, I think my concern is that, as you stated, Ms. Grom, we've worked a lot here with getting our ASAM specific treatment places for the specific need of the patient or the person in recovery, whether it's brain trauma, whether it's different levels. And so we are painstakingly trying to get people to the right place before four other treatment centers have failed. Now, maybe we need to talk to other providers about the ones that are assigned for those kinds of specialty care. How can we help patients that want to make sure they have a zero religious input or lack thereof or something? So I think this is a process for me, Representative Freiberg, that I want to get my head around, because I think that I really want to hear from more providers that want to offer these very good services to the right person, so their assessment, when their assessment is done, they get to the right place. But how can we just not eliminate them because they have a cross on the wall? And I just want to make sure that we look at the reality to this and how the providers will help us guide this kind of policy. So that's really all I have to say right now, I guess, at this point. And I'm happy to visit with more folks on this issue. That's my biggest fear, is it's going to create too many roadblocks and hurdles and more complications in a system that's already overly complicated by trying to get to what we want to get to. So I'm hoping we can find a way to do that.
All right. Thank you, Representative Baker. Appreciate that. Thank you, Director Brown, for coming down. Next on the list, I have Representative Coran.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Chair Freiberg, for bringing this bill forward. I know that this can be somewhat of a sensitive topic for folks to talk about, and I appreciate that you're tackling another tough topic for us. And I just wanted to make a comment that a lot of bills that we've been seeing throughout a lot of different committees are coming forward with an emphasis on culturally responsive and supportive services in a wide variety of areas throughout the legislature. And I see this as one of those bills. I just want to make sure that, you know, to say that having freedom of religion also means freedom from religion. And that's that's a valid choice that we have in this country. And so for some folks, that is going to make a life-changing difference when they're looking for this type of service to be successful in recovery. If someone is not connecting with religious teachings, but they can connect with another philosophy, with something else, connect in other ways and be successful in other ways, I think that we should make sure folks have that option, especially when over a third of Minnesotans are either non-religious or belong to a religious minority. So I really appreciate where you're coming with this. I think this will provide opportunities for success for a whole lot more people, and I appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Coran. From there, we'll go to Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Freiberg. This is a good bill. Happy to support it. One of the other efforts that is going on in the legislature is we often hear about the 1115 waiver that I know Chair Knorr is also advocating for. My question then is that, is there intersectionality between what you're advocating for along with the 1115 waiver in regarding the requirements for the 1115 waiver in AA services? And how do those two bills interact with each other? I want to make sure that we can do both, and if there's going to be conflict, that we just address that too.
I would probably defer over to Chair Knorr, seeing this starts falling into what he's been working on.
I would greatly appreciate that.
So, Chair Knorr, I'll let you take first swipe at it there.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I think the question about the 1115 waiver is for pre-release individuals so that they can get their coverage, mm-hmm. at least 90 days to what I want to do, so that when they're released, they already have their coverage, they get the care that they need, the medications that they need while they're still incarcerated. So I think there isn't much of interaction, but then when someone is already being in the process of being pre-released, this may come into play. So I think that is after the fact.
Okay. Vice Chair Frederick. Okay. And then next I have Representative Edelson.
No, I'm good.
All right. Seeing no other questions out there, back to Chair Freiberg. I invite you to make any closing comments.
Thank you. I really appreciate the discussion. The intent of this bill is just one of greater options and more culturally appropriate ones, as you pointed out, Representative Curran. The programs that are out there right now do a great job for a lot of people, but they don't work for everybody. So happy to keep working with people as this moves forward. I really appreciate your time. I do think this is a goal we should move towards, though. So thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you, Chair Freiberg. I will renew my motion that House File 3486, as amended, be referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed saying nay.
Nope.
The motion is approved, and House File 3486, as amended, is re-referred to the Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Next, I have Representative Edelson, House File 4362. Representative Edelson, if you'd like to come down to your to the table and move your bill, please.
Like, where are you? Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would move that House File 4362 be moved to the General Register.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Edelson. If you'd like to go ahead and explain your bill, please.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be super quick here because this is the policy bill for DCT, so I'm going to actually let Ms. Bruns explain it.
Good afternoon, Chair and members.
Good afternoon. Thank you for being here. Welcome to the committee. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Carrie Briones. I'm the Legislative Director for Direct Care and Treatment, and I will provide a quick overview of this bill. This was also had in an informational hearing about a month ago, so I'll try to keep more of a Cribs Notes version for you. So sections 1 through 17 of the bill in front of you are really related to bloodborne pathogen testing in our non-secure parts of direct care and treatment. Currently in our secure settings, if there is a potential exposure, DCT is able to obtain a court order to require patients to submit to a bloodborne pathogen test if they decline to do so. This is not the case in our secure facilities. If there, and this proposal is intending to give secure facilities the same ability. In our non-secure facilities, for following a potential exposure, what happens is if a patient does not submit to that bloodborne pathogen test, the staff in those non-secure settings are really just left without information that's valuable for them in whether to obtain a course of treatment. If a staff member experiences that potential exposure, like all of us, they need to make decisions about whether or not to obtain treatment, and they're kind of left with an uncertain amount of information. They might make a different medical decision if they know that there's been a confirmed exposure versus not. So in some cases, staff are left with perhaps receiving treatment that they don't need to receive or foregoing it when they probably should have. And for an example, these would address conditions like hepatitis B and C, HIV, and other chronic and very life-altering health conditions. At the end of the day, what this is intended to do is give staff and all of our facilities the same peace of mind, information, and ability to make decisions for their own health care. The incident currently in our secure settings of DCT obtaining a court order because a patient has declined to get that test is very low. We do not expect this to change. Usually when this conversation happens, the client and or their guardian agrees to have that test because it also benefits that client to know their status and to be able to obtain or make that decision about retaining treatment. So again, we don't expect an increase in those court orders. We also have reached out to stakeholders and advocates and have not received any opposition about this change at this point. And then the last part of the bill, which is just section 18, is really technical in nature, and it fixes an incorrectly listed member of the Priority Admissions Task Force. As you may recall, last session, legislation was passed that created this task force, and when the legislation was passed, a member was listed with an incorrect name. There was no organization in the state of Minnesota operating under that name. We did identify the correct one, and that's the member that did serve on that task force. And when this was discovered during the appointment process, the Secretary of State merely recommended that we come back and ask for a correction on that. So that's all that one is, and I'll stand for questions if anybody has any.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it, Director. Is there anyone else that would like to address the committee on House File 4362? Not seeing any members. Any questions or comments? First person I have is Representative Backer.
Thank you, Chair. My question, just so I get an understanding, what situation or experience generated this? Was there a case that happened that came about, or just was wondering what, because generally we legislate based on things that has happened to individuals, constituents, just like a brief overview of what led to this policy, potential policy.
Very good. I see we are phoning a friend here. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Yes, I'm Jacqueline Sammons. I'm a nurse executive with the Mental Health Substance Abuse Treatment Services Division of Direct Care and Treatment.
Okay, thank you. Please go ahead and answer the question.
Yes, thank you. So there was not one specific instance that came with this bill in front of you. However, what we were doing in terms of looking at the separation, looking at what opportunities we have for staff protection across all of direct care and treatment, and so to provide that same security of mind to individuals who work in our non-secure settings as well as the ones that currently work in the secure settings.
Representative Backer.
No further follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Edelson, for bringing this forward. I really appreciate it. Had a related conversation in another committee earlier today, and so I just wanted to make a note for folks that we do have an increase of HIV cases happening in Minnesota, in both Minneapolis and in Duluth, and there are a lot of ways that we can help mitigate the spread of that. Just wanted to bring awareness to that. This bill is certainly one way that we can address the issue, so thank you for bringing it forward.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Representative Curran. Not seeing any other comments or questions, Representative Edelson, any further closing comments that you'd like to make?
No, I just thank the committee for your support, and I would renew my motion to re-refer House File 4362 to the General Register.
Okay, very good. Representative Edelson moves to re-refer House File 4362 to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion is approved, and House File 4362 is referred to the General Register. Next on the agenda is House File 4289 from Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen, if you'd like to come down to the table, please. If you'd like to go ahead and move your bill, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Committee. I move that House File 4289 be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee after hours.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Hansen. If you'd like to go ahead and explain your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. I want to start off by clarifying that this bill is a work in progress, and I'm bringing it before you today to initiate the necessary conversations to address this particular workforce shortage area with innovation. This is just the beginning of many critical conversations about the drastic state of our mental health workforce shortage. So this bill, nor any single bill, will fix the fiasco that we're in. This bill would temporarily allow licensed graduate social workers, known as LGSWs, to lead mental health crisis intervention teams, as opposed to only licensed independent clinical social workers, or LICSWs, to lead crisis teams for just a short period of time. LGSWs can already assess clients, write treatment plans, and admit people to hospitals for mental health care, and we feel that they are also fully capable of helping fill this gap and lead crisis teams as a short-term bridge while we worked on the larger crisis at hand. Allowing them to do so would address the short-term needs of this critical workforce shortage of mental health professionals, also known as MHPs, while ensuring that our state's network of mental health crisis teams can deliver the care that people experiencing mental health emergencies need and deserve, while also recognizing the need for high-quality care to be delivered by adequately trained and licensed professionals. We have an alarming shortage, members, and to the public, and we should all be really concerned about how many mental health practitioners we are missing in Minnesota. And while that means that, of course, many people can't access therapy, it also means that counties and nonprofits across the state are unable to hire the appropriate number of staff on mental health crisis teams to meet the demand for these services. This would expand the eligible pool of MHPs just temporarily while we work to take other steps to increase the number of MHPs in Minnesota. Without adequately staffed crisis response teams, Minnesotans in crisis and their families do not get the level of care that they need and deserve in the timely and emergency manner that they need. Mental health crises can emerge without warning or after a lifetime of intervention. And many people are unaware of how significantly understaffed this field is until they or someone they love needs the help. And too often, the inadequacies of our system are not realized until it's too late for a beloved Minnesotan. Too many people have lost their lives in the throes of a mental health crisis, and it's critical that this committee and this entire body and legislature do everything we can to expand access to these necessary services statewide and save lives. It's critical to support our public safety system by ensuring we are exploring innovative solutions to address both the short-term and long-term crisis that our state is in. This workforce shortage is significantly experienced in outstate Minnesota and in greater and rural Minnesota. And I have some testifiers here who will read some testimony and share some stories to really elaborate on how significantly this shortage is impacting people's lives and how drastically we need this body to take action. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. First person I have for testifying is Michelle Gross. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for taking the time to be here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and committee members. My name is Michelle Gross, and I am the chair of the mental health work group of CUAPB. Our work group consists of individuals who are impacted specifically by the need for mental health crisis services. Some of us have lived experience. Some of us have our family members, as am I, and some are mental health professionals on our team. Minnesota is unique in that people in all 87 counties of this state have access to high-quality mental health crisis response services. Minnesota Statute 256B.0624 outlines the requirements for the teams that provide these services. In particular, the teams must be comprised of mental health practitioners and led by mental health professionals. These mental health professionals are LICSWs or psychologists. The teams must be available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This means that vulnerable people can get the critical services when they need them most. At least that's how it's supposed to be on paper. However, a shortage of mental health professionals, or MHPs, in rural areas puts the provision of these services in jeopardy. The National Rural Health Association tells us that 60% of rural Americans live in areas where there is a shortage of mental health professionals. This is certainly the case in rural Minnesota. Our organization spent a year and a half developing a white paper on decreasing interactions between law enforcement and people experiencing mental health crisis. And our paper is the defining paper that's used all over the country. More than that, we are the authors of Travis's Law, which passed in 2021, requiring 911 call centers to deflect mental health crisis calls to our mental health crisis teams. I've traveled the state talking to mental health crisis teams to find out from them what they need to actually implement Travis's Law. I'll be short. The shortage of mental health professionals is the issue that comes up over and over and over again. One such organization, Horizon Homes, provides mental health crisis services for 10 rural counties in southwest Minnesota. Two licensed clinical social workers for several months provided 24-hour coverage 7 days a week with no days off due to their workforce shortage. They begged us to bring this bill forward. This bill would temporarily allow licensed graduate social workers who again have master's degrees and are allowed to create treatment plans, assess people, and admit people to hospitals to lead these teams to get us out of this workforce emergency. I ask you to please support this bill so that rural Minnesotans can access the mental health crisis teams that they need when they need them. Thank you. And now I'm going to turn this over to Jay Sykes.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Gross. Welcome, Jay Sykes. Thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself, who you're with, and then begin your testimony.
Yes, my name is Jay Sykes. Thank you, committee. I don't know any of the rules here, so if I need my hand slapped, please do. I'm just going to briefly tell my story, if that's okay. My stepson, we lost in December of 2022. He was unfortunately going through a mental health crisis. We had tried 8 or 9 times calling to get welfare checks and to get someone out there in Sibley County to help him. And finally ended up having to go through the courts and got guardianship of him, met law enforcement there that day and was hoping to get him the help that he needed and get him into the hospital. Unfortunately, the law enforcement, there was no of the mental health providers there to provide guidance, the expert guidance that is needed in these situations. And he was, shot 9 times, including the back of his head. At 34 years old, he had never heard a fly. And I think there is a drastic need that we get the mental health people where they need to be. if I was going to invite you all out for dinner, I would make sure it was a James Beard person, right? But I wouldn't want that cook actually operating on an aneurysm if I had one, right? So I just want to make sure we get the right people in the right spot for the best possible outcomes. And I just thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Sykes, for sharing your story and condolences on the loss of your stepson. I appreciate you coming forward and helping us understand the seriousness of the issue out there. Is there anyone else that would like to testify before the committee? Not seeing any, I'll go to member questions and comments. Representative Finke.
Thanks, Chair Fisher. I just want to say to Representative Hansen, thank you so much for bringing this bill to your testifier. I'm so sorry for your loss. These losses are very tragic, and more so because of how preventable they are. So I know we have a sunset date in this, and that's the only part that I would like to talk about. I don't know what's going to change between now and then. I think we're just going to need more. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Finke. Next, I have Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. How would people access these services? Would they just be a recommendation? Would they dial 911, 988? You know, obviously when they dial 911, the ambulance shows up. That's people in my field. But help us how, or maybe it's you're doing it already. Fill in the gap here, please. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Backer. In 2021, in a divided legislature, we collectively passed a law called Travis's Law in honor of Travis Jordan, who was killed in the throes of a mental health crisis by Minneapolis police. That law requires that 911 operators dispatch a local mental health crisis intervention team in addition to the existing public safety professionals that show up, paramedics, fire, police, whichever is most appropriate. That law has unfortunately not been implemented as we maybe necessarily imagined, and for a number of reasons. This bill is in part one of the reasons why it has not been able to be implemented as widely as we would like. The workforce shortage has created really short staffing. As you heard, we have two workers who worked around the clock to do this. So we need to take all the innovative steps we can so that when someone calls 911 and asks for that mental health crisis intervention team to be dispatched in addition to the other public safety teams, that there's somebody to do the work. And unfortunately, right now, we are in a shortage. As a lot of us know, we're 16,000 police officers short in the state of Minnesota. By 2030, DEED estimates that we'll be 16,000 social workers short in Minnesota. So right now, you can call 911 to ask for mental health support. But as we just heard from our testifiers, that unfortunately does not always produce a mental health practitioner in being available at the scene when it is needed. 988 is also a bill that I worked on last year. It is fully funded, and I am happy to report after conversations with United Way that 100% of our 988 mental health calls are being answered by a Minnesotan now, which was not the case before we passed that bill. So we are taking incremental steps to make sure that we can continue to build this out, but unless and until we address the workforce shortages, we can pass all the laws we want and throw all the money we want at it. If there's no one there to do the work, that's where we're going to run into it. We also have put all of this onto police. We expect them to show up to these calls. Paramedics are doing a great job of supporting them, but we have to continue to support our officers and support our local public safety teams to be there and help them respond to these calls as they've asked us to do around the state.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And you are accurate. As an EMT, I've been on these runs. There was one time that actually we have Region 4, and nothing against them. It was a Friday night at about 11:30 that we were on a scene. The deputy and I was on scene with a behavioral challenge, and I called for help. And it was me, myself, and I because they were busy. So, one thing that you said, it is very important, and hats off to law enforcement. In our area, it's law enforcement or myself or the EMT, we only have four of us, that handles these. And I know law enforcement, I've seen them do phenomenal thing with lack of training. So something to think about that we need to look into providing more training because those police officers, those uniform officers do a phenomenal job to provide public safety and anything we can do as a body to help them. So thank you for recognizing that shortage is affecting how we provide mental crisis. We do need a better avenue, but right now we have to support what we have in the field. So thank you.
Becker. Next, I have Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Hansen. You said early on this is going to take more work, and it's got more stops. Thank you for that. I agree with a lot of things that have been said today. We don't have a choice. And if we can find folks, we need to give more wiggle room, and probably at times we don't know that this is the right thing to do. The one thing that Representative Backer was bringing up is really, for me, I want to get behind something very, very strongly if I know that our law enforcement teams are behind this too. Where are they at on this bill at this point?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker. Personally, I reside from a city who has recently undergone a pretty significant crisis. And I know in my city and both of the cities I represent, they have employed social workers on their team. And so they aren't just brought in from the county. They're embedded within our city staff. So that's really important. I would actually recommend that I allow my testifier to speak to this because she's really the expert. She's been having conversations around the state with a number of different law enforcement officials and mental health practitioners. And so if it's okay with you, Chair, I would ask that my testifier be allowed to answer that question.
Sure, Ms. Gross, if you could, and keep it short, because we do have two other bills we want to get to today.
Thank you for the question. One of the groups that I cited was Horizon Homes, which is an organization out of Blue Earth County. They work exclusively and extensively with law enforcement. Law enforcement provides them backup. They provide backup to law enforcement. If law enforcement goes to a call and they recognize a behavioral crisis, they call in that team right away. They have a very great relationship that has a rock solid relationship. And this is the kind of thing we want to see built out all over the whole state. Where there's enough people to be able to do the work, and law enforcement feels comfortable working with these teams, and the teams feel comfortable working with law enforcement. That is the goal. Thank you.
Chair, if I could also just add to this is my favorite issue to work on in the legislature because we need to save lives. And so this, like I mentioned, is one of many issues that I'm working on. You're welcome. I invite folks, come to my office and chat with me. I will get on a soapbox and tell you about the whole vision of how we're really trying to address our mental health workforce crisis and how we're also intersecting this with some of our EMT services and how paramedics have asked us if they can have a social worker on the bus with them. And lots of conversations are happening. And my 4 years here, I'm really excited to see the progress we've made. And so while we haven't made all the solutions we need, I do think this body should be proud of ourselves for at least advancing the conversation on a bipartisan basis with all of the parties at the table.
Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Just to wrap that up, Mr. Chair, if I could just comment. Baker. Again, can get behind a bill or not behind a bill, I want to make sure that our law enforcement leadership is behind this because we're talking about unsupervised. And I don't know how that word makes them nervous. That's all that I am. And it was just more of a comment, Mr. Chair, because I know you're short of time. So thank you.
Chair, I can speak to that if I could just 1 second. So this is not about law enforcement does not supervise mental health practitioners. Mental health practitioners supervise mental health practitioners. So these teams work in conjunction and in collaboration with law enforcement, but law enforcement does not supervise them. So this is a separate supervision path on the other side.
Thank you. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be very brief. Thank you, Rep. Hansen, for bringing this forward. I just wanted to note we know that suicide has touched far, far too many of us. And I wanted to say to Mr. Sykes, I'm so sorry for your loss. And thank you for coming here and doing something with that experience. I'm really appreciative that you're here today. We know that our mental health needs have increased, and police have a large job, often acting as a social worker and doing the best with the knowledge and tools that we have. And I think, at this point, it's all hands on deck. And we have people who are willing to jump in and be helpful, who have the knowledge and skills and the expertise. And so anything we can do to fill those roles, I will always be supportive of. And I'm so glad to see you addressing the workforce shortage in this way. I do think this will save lives, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Grant. Representative Hansen, if you'd like to give a very brief closing comment.
I promise, very short. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members, for a good conversation. And thank you again to our testifiers for being here. And our condolences for your loss and for everybody in Minnesota who's lost a loved one too soon. I am looking forward to continuing the conversations and ongoing. In your inboxes, members, you'll find a link to the latest KSTP investigative journalist report that was done about Brent's family. So please take a moment to watch that and learn more about how you can continue to help us solve this really drastic crisis. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hansen moves to re-refer House File 4289 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed saying nay. Motion is approved and House File 4289 is re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Next bill up is House File 4106, a Chair Knorr bill. Chair Knorr, if you'd like to move your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 4106, re-refer to Finance and Policy.
Okay, very good. And Chair Knorr, I understand you have an A1 author's amendment. Would you like to explain the A1 author's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move A1 amendment. The A1 amendment makes a couple of changes. It creates a smart referral team so that the hospital mm-hmm. can send directly the smart review to the smart review team. The second part establishes the escalation process for medical assistance application. The other section creates simplification of mean choices process.
Okay, very good. Any questions on the A1 author's amendment? Hearing none, all in favor of the author's A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed say nay. Motion carries and the A1 amendment is adopted. Chair Knorr, would you like to please explain your House File 4106 as amended?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure you've heard a lot about hospital decompression, and this bill, Mr. Chair, addresses that issue, the core issue here that we're trying to solve. I'll be brief on this bill. It addresses three main components. The first thing is streamlines and prioritize when people are stuck in hospital by making sure that there is a process to get the medical assistant eligibility determination done, the mean choice assessment process, but also the rate setting for the community providers. That's in a simple way of how I'll put the bill, and this is a bill that is work in progress with all the stakeholders, and we'll continue working on it. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. We have several testifiers. I know we'll be limiting testifiers to 2 minutes each, so we can try to get to the last bill we have. First testifier I have is Dr. Ryan Greiner. If you could please introduce yourself to the committee. Thank you for taking the time to be here today.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify on this important legislation. My name is Ryan Greiner. I'm a physician at North Memorial Health for the last 10 years. While I continue to practice as a hospitalist and internist at the Robbinsdale campus treating patients admitted with acute medical conditions, I also oversee the work of our utilization and case management teams. This means I actively participate in solving for the increasingly complex discharge barriers for patients who need direct engagement with state and county agencies, along with the court system, in order to discharge them to appropriate and safe environments. These are unique and complex challenges that go beyond the issues of capacity in our post-acute skilled care facilities and add to the uncompensated care that we provide. As you're likely aware, hospital stays are paid based on the acute care conditions and their treatments. If it's a fixed payment based on a predicted length of stay for their medical condition. When a patient stays longer than expected for custodial reasons, the hospital is no longer reimbursed. However, we continue to provide those services, doing our best to prevent hospital-based complications and keep the patients safe. And it's not easy. Hospitals are not designed to care for patients who don't need active medical care. Imagine the impact of an elderly patient with dementia who would benefit from social interaction, time outside, and specialized therapies, to name a few. They aren't getting those in a hospital. Equally as important, these patients occupy beds and take up resources that are then not available to patients who need acute care. This has had a significant impact on overwhelming the emergency departments, limiting the transfers we can take from outside hospitals, as well as the ability for patients to get much-needed surgical procedures. It disrupts patient flow through our healthcare ecosystem, creates financial strain, and jeopardizes the ability to deliver on our mission to serve the vulnerable communities that depend on us. As Chair Knorr noted, delays are for many reasons, like the lack of bed capacity or staff in many post-acute care settings, but in the instances of extremely prolonged delays, these are most typically due to state and county processes. So I want to leave you with two main points today before I turn it over. First, hospitals are designed to safely treat acute care needs. They're not designed for long-term stays. They're not optimized or conducive for long-term health. Last thing, we have, within our hospitals, been working extremely hard on this problem, being creative, trying to partner with the counties, but we need more, and that's what this bill addresses. I'll defer to my colleague from Minnesota Fairview.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Greiner. Next is Heather Kelly. If you'd like to please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. You'll have 2 minutes.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4106. My name is Heather Kelly. I am a licensed clinical social worker and a member of the Care Management Department for Fairview Health Services, primarily working in inpatient care management services for the University of Minnesota Medical Center. The inpatient care management team consists of nurse care coordinators, social workers, and community health workers that assist with coordinating discharge plans for patients when they are ready to leave the hospital. We are grateful to Chair Fisher and others for bringing this bill forward, as this bill will have a vast impact on the patients and family members that our healthcare system serves. One of the most significant challenges we currently face as a health system is helping our patients find and secure appropriate settings to discharge to in the community once they no longer need an acute care hospital stay. Patients who are unable to secure discharge plans for that can meet their needs end up staying in our hospitals for weeks and months past when they are medically ready to discharge. Through the first 10 months of last year, Fairview had over 20,000 avoidable patient bed days for patients who are quote unquote stuck in our hospitals due to discharge barriers and delays. This challenge is not unique to our hospitals nor to Minnesota, but unfortunately is impacting hospitals across our country. These avoidable days cause our hospital beds to be at or over capacity on a daily basis, and thus we do not have beds available for all of the patients that present to our emergency department. This creates a backlog of patients boarding in our emergency departments waiting on an inpatient hospital bed to open up. This causes an immense amount of frustration for the patients that we serve and their family members. On any given day, we have 60 to 80 patients who have no medical need to be hospitalized, but who remain in our hospital related to discharge barriers. This bill takes some important steps to help reduce the delays experienced by our medically ready to discharge patients that are created by lengthy state and hospital eligibility processes. All right, I'm going to skip to our example. We have a patient that was hospitalized for 189 days. Due to the medical complexities and lack of skilled nursing facility beds, the patient was globally denied from all TCUs. He received therapies and rehabbed here in our hospital. The family petitioned for guardianship. That took 5 weeks to get a court date. Once guardianship was in place and family had obtained needed proofs, they had a medical assistance application submitted. That took 8 weeks to get approved. A referral was made for a MnChoice assessment, which took 6 weeks to get scheduled. Once the MA was approved and the assessment was completed, the patient had to be SMRTed, the waiver had to be opened, the care management department had to find an accepting group home, and the group home in the county had to agree upon a rate. The patient only had a medical need to be hospitalized for 17 days, but remained in the hospital an additional 172 days while the care management team worked through the aforementioned barriers. Thank you, Chair Fisher, for your leadership on this issue. We look forward to continuing to work with you on all of these challenging situations for patients and their families. Thank you.
Thank you. And finally, I have Evan Henspeter. If you'd like to come down, please, and you'll have two minutes.
Thank you, Chair Chair Fisher and Representative Knorr and members of the committee. My name is Gilbert Acevedo. Director Henspeter was unable to make it today, so I'm stepping in to testify today.
Okay, thank you for coming in, filling in for him. Appreciate it. Welcome to the committee.
Okay, thank you. As I said, my name is Gilbert Acevedo. I'm a Deputy Social Services Director in Dakota County. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Social Services Administrators, or MACSA, and the Minnesota Intercounty Association, MICA. From a high level, I want to say that counties agree with the expressed concerns of people not being able to be discharged from hospital settings in a timely manner. We support some of the language in the bill and the amendment. However, we do have concerns about some of the provisions and believe that there may be a more practical way to approach the effective solutions. With regard to MnChoices, the counties have been engaged with hospitals disability advocates from the ARC Minnesota and DHS with focus on reducing the complexity of the assessment itself. Counties support the change to allow assessments to remain valid for 365 days, which avoids staff and clients needing to complete repeat work through the eligibility update process. We support credentialing changes related to MnChoice's certified assessors. We believe that eliminating the requirement that the person have at least 2 years experience specifically related to home community-based services will help with the workforce issues that we are all experiencing. I do have some concerns about the timeline and the process and the provision. First, I can attest the counties would already be meeting the timelines laid out in the legislation if we had the capacity. Unfortunately, the current system and program expectations make it unattainable and frankly unrealistic. Putting emphasis on people in hospital settings would force the counties to shift and pull resources away from other individuals who may have more intense medical, psychiatric, or safety needs and persons awaiting discharge from the hospital. Finally, while we understand the intention of creating an initial financial incentive for providers through a supplemental payment, this would cause unnecessary strife between the county and providers when ongoing rates later need to be reduced to comply with state standard. I look forward to continuing the discussion with legislators and hospitals to collaborate in ways to solve this complex system. Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Knorr, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Okay.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Are there any further testifiers who would like to address the committee? Not seeing any members, any questions or comments? Not seeing any. Chair Knorr, would you like to renew your motion and provide closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is work in progress, so I'll renew my motion to refer House file as amended. House File 4106 to Health, Finance, and Policy Committee.
Chair Knorr moves to refer House File 4106 as amended to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion is approved and House File 4106 is amended and re-referred to the Health, Finance Committee. And with that, I'll turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Frederick as I introduce the next bill.
As soon as you get situated, Chair Fisher, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Vice Chair. Yes, I would like to move House File 4393 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee, and I also have an author's amendment.
Would you like to move the author's amendment and explain it, please?
Yes, I have an author's I'd like to move the author's A1 amendment. This is to get the bill in the shape I would prefer. It does several changes. It changes the background studies statutes to account for the adult use cannabis that is decriminalized now. It also addresses the situation and clarifies the situation around needing to have a licensed physical location in Minnesota where they provide services, clarify that they can provide telehealth services to a group of clients that are in separate locations, and that is the amendment.
Any discussion to the A1 author's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. The A1 is adopted. Chair Fisher, please introduce your bill as amended.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frederick. Just as a quick overview, and then I can turn it over to my testifier here to go more into detail. This bill is a Department of Human Services Officer of the Inspector General policy bill. It makes technical fixes and policy changes to licensing requirements, including modifying the process for changing ownership of license programs and allowing the DHS commissioner to set terms for how programs are complying with issues. It also modifies provisions related to the background study procedures. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you. Up next is Director Aria Didion. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Aria Didion. I'm the Acting Legislative Director for the DHS Office of Inspector General. Here to talk about the Office of Inspector General policy bill. And since we only have a few minutes left, I will give you the fast version of the overview of our bill. So section one of the bill relates to a proposal to make license holders' emails public. And this is just in order to be able to share those email addresses when requested, particularly by other state agencies. And other parts of DHS. And that provision excludes family child foster care from the list of providers that have to have a public email for privacy reasons. Sections 2, 3, 11 through 16, 36, 39, 40 through 45, 48 and 49 are a series of fairly technical changes to licensing statute. These mostly relate to items that were passed in previous legislative sessions, and cleanup and conforming changes. Some examples of that are in 2023, a proposal passed to allow for emergency overdose medication in several types of license programs. And so the provisions related to this just clean up some areas of law where this wasn't added and clarifies that staff are allowed to carry emergency overdose medications, that they are allowed to have naloxone readily available in the program and not locked up, and then allow staff to be trained only on administering emergency overdose medications if it is the only medication that they administer. There's also a couple of provisions related to family child care and conforming licensing statute with the state fire code. We passed several of these changes last year. This proposal just adds a couple more of those changes related to the fire code. There's also changes related to community residential settings that were inadvertently missed. These are just conforming changes. There are also changes to mental health services in Chapter 245I. This is related to the Uniform Services Standards Act that passed in 2021, I believe. And so these are in response to stakeholder feedback and our experience as we have been implementing the law. There's also provisions related to contraindicated restraints. This was an item that was passed last year, and there's a couple of cross-references that this corrects. And then there are also a series of changes related to conforming state licensing regulations with federal requirements for opioid treatment programs. And there's a provision related to assisted living licensure and exclusion from licensure. There is a requirement for maltreatment finding reconsideration requests to be submitted through the licensing provider and reporting hub. And then I will also note that section 2 of the bill, which is removed by the amendment, was related to this series of changes. That was removed based on conversations with the advocates. We decided that that was just not quite ready yet. Sections 4, 37, and 41 relate to a proposal for license holders to update DHS when there are changes in certain key staff positions. And so these are positions like the medical director, registered nurses, LADCs, and so they are license holders are already required to have these positions filled. These changes just require license holders to update DHS within 5 days of a change. Sections 5 through 9 of the bill relate to a proposal related to a change of ownership for licenses. This was something that passed previously, but there was a lack of clarity, and so these provisions just clarify when a change of ownership is necessary and outline some of the terms for a temporary change of ownership license. Sections 17 through 19, 21 through 31, 34, and 35 are from our background studies division. These changes are largely conforming changes and cleanup that align Chapter 245C with other areas of law, as well as with criminal code and expungement code. These don't add new disqualifications. They're just cleaning up and conforming 245C. Section 20 is related to a proposal to give DHS the authority to authorize name and date of birth only background studies in an emergency. This was something that DHS did under the governor's emergency authority during the COVID-19 pandemic. And so this just kind of outlines that option in the event that fingerprinting locations were to ever close down due to a similar emergency. Sections 32 and 33 relate to another background studies proposal. This proposal is conforming Chapter 245C with federal law, and it is aligning child foster care studies with other types of background studies. Sections 46 and 47 relate to a proposal to, oops, I lost my place here, going too fast. This is from our Program Integrity Division. This is just changing the word certified mail to confirmed delivery. We previously had a change pass that required a signature verified confirmed delivery method for certain mailings. And this just expands that so there are other types of signature confirmed delivery options apart from just certified mail. Section 10 of the bill relates to a proposal to allow the licensing division to put in place conditions when a revocation of a license is under appeal, when a provider's license is revoked, they're allowed to continue operating while under appeal. And so this just gives DHS the authority to put in some conditions while that license is under appeal. And then section 38. Just give me 1 second. I'm switching to the fast version of my talking points today. This relates to a proposal from the licensing division for off-site substance use disorder treatment services. It updates some standards and clarifies the locations of services for substance use disorder treatment programs. And I would be happy to answer questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Director Didion. At this point, I will turn it over to member questions. First up, we've got Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, and thank you for being here to answer questions. I have a couple of questions about Section 20, so the emergency waiver to temporary modified background study requirements. My first question is, I know when we did that before, sometimes people ended up paying twice. Would that happen in this scenario as well, or would it just be like, you pay once and we'll get you later?
Director Didion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, do you mean that they paid twice, so they paid the fee for the emergency study and then paid the fee again? I am not sure. Let me just see if anyone is trying to get me answers from the audience. I don't have that one. We can follow up on that for you. I don't know if the statutory change is that specific.
Representative Hicks.
So I guess my concern is, are background studies, accessing background studies in greater Minnesota is a major issue. The centers just randomly close. There's like a post-it note on the door. People have driven and shown up to do those, and now they've got this delay. And so if we were to ever need to use the emergency waiver again, I would want to make sure we weren't charging people twice, because that seems not super fair. I'm also, you know, I still continue to be concerned about access to background studies in greater Minnesota. And I'm not seeing anything in this bill that addresses that. I know we've had lots of conversations and there are other bills, but I actually could see how an emergency waiver could be helpful in a situation where a location shuts down. But I want to make sure that I'm not going to be asking my providers to pay $42 on the first of the month, and then when we find a location on the first of the next month, ask them to pay it again. So I'd really like an answer on that and if we need to make any adjustments to ensure that doesn't happen.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Didin.
I just got a kind of brief answer. We'll do a little bit more follow-up, but our intent with this, with the proposal, is to avoid some of the issues that we had when we authorized the COVID waiver, and so that's part of why we're outlining it in statute. And I'll also note that we did pass some credits, some funding to cover some of the COVID studies. So I will follow up with staff and get more information for the committee.
Perfect. Thank you. Next up is Representative Backer.
Thank you. A question is just, I think it's a simple question, but obviously DHS does a lot of stuff through their counties. What feedback have you got from the counties on this policy bill?
Ms. Didion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Backer, I would have to go through and look at which provisions specifically impact counties. Generally, for licensing, there are certain services that are licensed by our counties, and there are other services that are licensed directly by DHS. So I believe there are some provisions related to family child care in here. Those are licensed by the counties, as well as family child foster care. And I could follow up with the committee on some information about the outreach we did on those proposals.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would appreciate that because especially us counties in greater Minnesota, we just don't have the revenue to implement everything. So that would be very appreciated if you could share that. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Representative Baker.
Real quickly, Mr. Chair, maybe this is to Chair Fisher. Meritap, the Minnesota Alliance on Addiction Recovery, has a letter in here. Does your A1 fix a lot of this? I just want to make sure their voice is heard because I know we're very limited on time.
Chair Fisher.
Thank you. I've not had a chance to take a look at their testimony yet, so I'll have to be honest. I just can't answer that question right now.
Thank you. And again, Mr. Chair, just real quickly, we are, this is moving along. I want to make sure we address that for
definitely will.
Thank you.
Closing comments, Chair Fisher.
I am committed to making sure that we continue to address any issues that people bring forward, following up with the counties also. I ask for your support and we'll continue to work on this as we move it to the next stop. With that, I would like to renew my motion that House File 4393 as amended be referred to
Health
and Finance Policy Committee.
Chair Fisher moves to refer House File 4393 as amended to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say nay. Motion passes and House File 4393 as amended is referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Our next hearing will be on Monday, March 18th. We'll be hearing six bills from a variety of authors. Please note for your calendars that we will be meeting on Tuesday, March 19th of next week as well. Seeing no further business, we are adjourned.